the warming of the planet that's due to the burning of fossil fuels, by the very companies and plutocrats and petrostates that are behind the policies of this administration.
Said, not since the ransacking of the Library of Alexandria have we witnessed such a wanton, intentional assault on scientific knowledge. We have 30 seconds, Professor Mann.
Yeah, it's a line from my commentary. And, you know, there's some question as to the veracity of that story. But I think it captures sort of the insanity of what we're doing. We're literally destroying knowledge. And we have to look back to ancient times to see, you know, eras similar, you know, when barbarians tried to destroy knowledge. That's what this administration is doing. They're trying to destroy knowledge.
Michael Mann, professor at the University of Pennsylvania, co-author of the book Science Under Siege with Dr. Peter Hotez. We will link to your new piece out today in The Guardian. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for our video news production and digital fellowship programs. You can learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Nicole Salazar, Sarah Nasser, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Masood, Safwat Nazal, our executive director, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman.
Fresh Air Community Radio is KFAI-FM, Minneapolis-St. Paul. Online and archived at KFAI.org, the community's true voice.
Stay tuned for a celebration and exploration of the Bob Dylan album that Rolling Stone magazine readers rated as their top favorite of all his records, 1975's Blood on the Tracks.
The festival was over. The boys were all planning for a fall.
The New York sessions themselves didn't turn out very well. So finally, Dylan basically fired everybody.
Dylan said, "I don't like this album. I don't want to put it out." And he went back to Minneapolis, Minnesota.
And I walk through and I look in the studio and there's Bob. And I said, "David, that's your famous brother Bob." I said, "What's going on here?"
Someone's got it in for me. They're planting stories in the friend.
And he recorded for the second time half of the album.
Songwriting of the absolute highest order, there's simply no question about that.
It's a longing that we carry. Dylan has been the one to write about it the best.
Right on target, so direct. Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks.
That's today on Mini Culture Presents here on KFEI. I'm your curator, Michael Whetstone. On January 17th, 1975, Bob Dylan released the single Tangled Up in Blue with If You See Her, Say Hello on the flip side. A few days later, Blood on the Tracks landed in record shops, and now, 50 years later, as you heard, many still consider it to be his greatest LP. About 51 years ago, between September 16th and September 19th, Dylan was in New York City recording his first pass. Half of those songs made it to the final mix. He'd re-record in late December 1974 here in Minneapolis, and those re-recorded tracks would make it onto the final record. Today we're going to celebrate Blood on the Tracks with a deep dive and an in-depth appreciation for the record in a documentary from independent producer Paul Ingalls in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Reflect, reminisce, or introduce yourself to the beloved album for the first time with us here on Mini Culture Presents as we explore the creation of the record. Here's Paul.
In January of 1975, I dropped the needle for the first time on a new Bob Dylan record, likely in my dorm room at Wake Forest University where I was a freshman. Decades later, I'm still punching play and never ever skipping a song from Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks. And apparently, I'm not the only one.
Every time I've listened to Blood on the Tracks, I have to say it's had a profound impact on me. I mean, I remember one time hearing that song in a liquor store. I mean, I went in to buy a bottle of wine on my way to a party and Tangled Up in Blue came on the radio.
Early one morning the sun was shining, I was laying in bed, wondering if she'd changed it all, if her hair was still red.
And I stood there and just listened to it all the way through and I was devastated. it's songwriting of the absolute highest order. There's simply no question about that. And they're songs that hold together.
I would say that Blood on the Tracks stands as Bob Dylan's great adult album.
She was born in spring, but I was born too late. Blame it on this simple twist of fate.
It's corny to say Blood on the Tracks is the album that made me fall in love with Bob Dylan or with Bob Dylan's music, but in some ways there's no other way to say it.
Oh, that you can hear. Hear me singing through these tears.
When somebody mentioned to Dylan how much they liked it, his eyes went up. He said he couldn't imagine what they meant by liking something that was so filled with pain.
You have to get personal. So Dylan doing it in Blood on the Tracks just seemed part and parcel to me of a lot of things that I'd heard. Definitely made it okay for me to write. I didn't see any other way to write.
But this time round it's more correct. Right on target, so direct. You're gonna make the loads when you go.
Blood on the Tracks is kind of the middle of the story record. I tend to always like the middle of the story. What's that beautiful Picasso quote? Others talk, I work. He's just working.
Honey, I know I've earned your love.
The thing about Bob Dylan is he explained that when he started writing songs, he was doing it instinctively, and that he had to learn to do consciously what he used to be able to do unconsciously. He clearly found a technique for doing that in this album, and it's remarkable because he wrote songs unlike anything he'd ever written.
Lily called another bed and drew up the jag of hearts.
And I was kind of stunned by the directness, the simpleness, the intimacy, and the nakedness.
Oh, the bitter taste still lingers on from the night I tried to make her stay.
It's almost as if he had her, she slipped through his fingers, and now he's reaching for her again in another form, in another lifetime, and it continues to turn into smoke.
I came in from the wilderness, a creature void of form. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm.
Basically, I think everybody knows that all the songs are about the dissolution of his marriage, although Dylan denies that, of course. That record really feels of a piece, which is miraculous considering how it was made.
Everything about you is bringing me misery.
Yes, how the album was made. That is a story, and we'll tell that today, too. This is Right on Target, So Direct, Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks. I'm Paul Ingalls, and I'll introduce those other voices you heard soon. A panel assembled to talk about this record, which Rolling Stone magazine readers rated as their top favorite of all Bob Dylan's records in a 2012 poll. We'll hear excerpts from many of the key songs on the album. Now, there is a longer version of this show online at prx.org. It matches the commentary with the full songs, the full album. But since we only have this hour, the album itself is 52 minutes long, some excerpts of some songs it will be.
There must be some way out of here. Turn the joker to the thief. There's too much confusion. I can't get no relief.
Hi, I'm Anthony DeCurtis, a contributing editor at Rolling Stone. By the time of Blood on the Tracks, you know, Bob Dylan had gone back out on tour with the band in 1974, and that got a lot of attention. He had been in a fairly removed situation, you know, at the beginning of the 70s. And even though he had some hit records,
knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door,
there was generally a sense that Dylan was not the figure that we had seen him be in the 60s, you know, when he was a defining figure of that era. You know, he was regarded as somebody who had done great work in the past and was important, but, you know, he was not producing on the level of what he had done. Bob Dylan's personal life began to get complicated in the mid-70s as well. You know, he began an affair with a woman who worked at Columbia Records, And his marriage to Sarah Lowndes was really beginning to shake. That marriage was very important to Dylan, regardless of his other shenanigans. And his breakup with Sarah became a public issue, which really did not sit well with him. I mean, he's obviously a very private person. I think so all of this turmoil was something that was really kind of underlying a lot of what ended up on Blood on the Tracks. I remember interviewing Jacob Dylan one time, and he was talking about, you know, his father's work and his own relationship to it. He goes, well, look, it's one thing to listen to the classic stuff that my father did, and, you know, I can understand it and I can appreciate it. But when I listen to Blood on the Tracks, he goes, you know, that's about my parents. You know, it's that personal. And he understood that.
As Dylan was living the turmoil of an impending breakup, he was writing. And in September of 1974, he went to the studio with about a dozen songs ready to record for Columbia Records again with veteran producer Phil Ramone.
I'm John Spurney. I'm a musician and composer, and I live in New York City. Well, I've worked a lot with Eric Weisberg, who's a really respected musician around New York, session musician. He's probably most famous for playing the banjo on Dueling Banjos from Deliverance. So his band, Deliverance, was actually hired by Dylan to be the backing band for the first sessions for Blood on the Tracks. So on September 16th, 1974, they go into the A&R studios in New York, but the New York sessions themselves didn't turn out very well. They were kind of chaotic. Dylan moved very, very quickly. I think he's sort of infamous for doing this, but in the sessions for Blood on the Tracks, he was particularly fast to the point where, while they were listening to the playback of a take in the control room, Dylan would be teaching them the next song. So there'd be one song playing in the background while they were trying to learn a new song. And then if Dylan did multiple takes of songs, and for the guys in the band, they didn't know what he was going to do. And really, the only way you could possibly keep up was just to watch Dylan's hands and try and go to the chord his hand was going to. One of the things I love about the New York sessions, he was wearing a blazer with buttons on the cuffs. And so most of the New York tracks, if you listen to them with headphones, there's this incredible rattling of buttons hitting his acoustic guitar.
If you're making love to her, kiss her for the kid who always has respected her for doing what she did.
So the New York sessions didn't go particularly well. And I think it was a pretty tense situation for most of the guys there. And I think it was also exacerbated by the fact that, by all accounts, there was a lot of alcohol being used during the sessions. So finally, Dylan basically fired everybody except Tony Brown, the bass player, who was invited back a day later. And then I think a little later, he asked Paul Griffin, who was the guy who was playing organ on the sessions, to come back. And those are the guys that the New York portion of the album was actually cut with.
At the end of about 16 takes of the songs, again on day two of recording, two songs eventually made it to the released version of Blood on the Tracks. You're Gonna Make Me Lonesome When You Go and Shelter from the Storm.
Hi, this is Mary Gaucher, and I live in Nashville, Tennessee. And my personal favorite is Shelter from the Storm.
'Twas in another lifetime, one of toil and blood, when blackness was a virtue, the road was full of mud. I came in from the wilderness, a creature void of form. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm.
It starts in another lifetime. Who's done that before in songwriting? You know, it was in another lifetime. Like, well, what do you mean by that, Bob? Blackness was a virtue. Okay, this other lifetime wasn't any better than this one. The road was full of mud, and yet she was there, the muse, the woman, to help him.
Hi, I'm Ann Powers with NPR Music. As I've grown older and seen Dylan's work in context, I think of Shelter from the Storm as really related to the work of Leonard Cohen, songs of Leonard Cohen's like Suzanne, these songs that paint pictures that seem to come from any time in history. There's a way they could be medieval. There's a way they could be 19th century French stories. And I think Dylan was really going for that feeling with Shelter from the Storm. It's a ballad that unfolds, and it really feels like he's playing the balladeer and he's playing the official poet.
And yes, you can hear the buttons from his blazer banging on his guitar on this take too, but they kept it anyway for the next to last cut on side two of Blood on the Tracks.
Suddenly I turned around and she was standing there with silver bracelets on her wrists and flowers in her hair. She walked up to me so gracefully and took my crown of thorns. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. Now there's a wall between us, something that's been lost. I took too much for granted, I got my signals crossed. Just pretend till it all began on a non-eventful morn. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. Well, the deputy walks on hard nails and the preacher rides a mount. But nothing really matters much, it's doom alone that counts. And the one-eyed undertaker, he blows a feudal horn. Come in, she said, I'll give ya shelter from the storm.
Hi, I'm Ashley Kahn. I live in New Jersey, and I'm a music historian, author, and professor at New York University. A tune like You're Gonna Make Me Lonesome When You Go, it's absolutely one of the most joyous songs of like this innocent playfulness that comes in a relationship at the start when, you know, everything from the talking and the sex and the way that, you know, two people can fall into a relationship and fall in and out of bed and fall into the day and just have fun with each other. I don't think there's a song in Bob's catalog that is more frolicsome and more fun.
Hi, this is Peter Mulvey. I'm a singer and songwriter. I make my home in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. The songwriter is so brutally honest and brutally sharp. When he's talking about how wonderful this person is, he's also already seen through to the end of the relationship.
I've seen love go by my door. It's never been this close before. Never been so easy or so slow. Been shooting in the dark too long. When something's not right, it's wrong. You're gonna make me lonesome when you go. Dragging clouds so high above, I've only known careless love. It always has hit me from below. But this time round, it's more correct. Right on target, so direct. You're gonna make me lonesome when you go. Purple clover, Queen Anne lace, crimson hair across your face. You can make me cry if you don't know. Can't remember what I was thinking of. You might be spoiling me too much, love. You're gonna make me lonesome when you go. Flowers on the hillside blooming crazy. Crickets talking back and forth in rhyme. Blue River running slow and lazy. I could stay with you forever and never realize the time. Situations have ended sad, relationships have all been bad. Mine have been like Verlaine's and Rambo. But there's no way I can compare all them scenes to this affair. You're gonna make me lonesome when you go.
Hi, my name is Paul Zolo. I'm the author of the book Songwriters on Songwriting. I interviewed him in 1993, and I talked to him about his use of rhymes. And I mentioned that you rhyme like a romantic poet, like Byron or Shelley. And he said, you're right. And then he recited a Shelley line to me from memory. So this is a man who's not only in touch with rock and folk and blues and all the great American genres of music, but with all the generations of great romantic poetry, use of imagery and rhyme. And that all comes together with just a great care for craft, a great love for the songcraft.
Again, Rolling Stone magazine's Anthony DeCurtis.
Dylan is not a writer that often gets as personal as he gets on Blood on the Tracks.
not that the album is revealing in the way that we think, say, confessional poetry was revealing. You know, it's not I did this, she did that. It's not a chronicle of events. It's a chronicle of emotions. It covers just about every stop on the process of the breakup of a long marriage and a long relationship. You know, everything from bitter anger to wistfulness to sadness to hope for the future to a kind of acceptance that at times is pretty much indistinguishable from despair. All of that is in this record.
They sat together in the park as the evening sky grew dark. She looked at him and he felt a spark tingle to his bones. 'Twas then he felt alone and wished that he'd gone straight and watched out for a simple twist of fate. They walked along by the old canal, a little confused, I remember well, and stopped into a strange hotel with a neon burning bright. He felt the heat of the night hit him like a freight train moving with a simple twist of fate. Saxophone someplace far off played as she was walking on by the arcade, as the light bust through a beat up shade where he was waking up. She dropped a coin into the cup above a blind man at the gates and forgot about a simple twist of fate.
New York musician John Spurney.
One of Dylan's great, great talents is he has that, you know, poet's ability to write a narrative that's so open-ended, you can fit yourself into it. It winds up being somehow about your situation because there's so much space in the lyric. You can find something about yourself in it, even though obviously Dylan never intended it to be about you.
I'm Sean Colvin, a singer-songwriter from Austin, Texas. Yeah, there's something I call circular songs or cycle songs, and it's just the same thing over and over. There is no chorus. You know, it just resolves with a line that's the same line after every verse.
People tell me it's a sin to know and feel too much within. I still believe she was my twin, but I lost the rain. She was born in spring, but I was born too late. Blame it on this simple twist of fate.
Simple Twist of Fate. Cut 2 on Blood on the Tracks. Recorded at New York's A&R Studios in September of 1974.
It's a cliche to say that Bob Dylan is our greatest musical poet.
Here again from NPR Music is Ann Powers.
But what's interesting about his whole career is how it's gone through several different literary phases as well as musical and personal phases. We get Blood on the Tracks, which to me is sort of his naturalist, maybe realist. It's hard to apply that word, but it's sort of almost his great American novel period. The stories are more personal. They're of a piece with each other in a way that you can really sit there and listen to the whole album as if you were reading a novel by Dreiser or by a Russian novelist, those people he was reading at the time. And I feel like for Dylan, it was a new peak of maturity that meant he didn't have to preach from the mountain. He could just be right there on the ground with the rest of us talking about what we all go through when we fall in and out of love.
So after the 4 days of recording in New York in September of 1974 and some mixing by engineer Phil Ramone, Dylan was given a test pressing of what everyone assumed was a finished album. Columbia Records moved along toward a pre-Christmas release, while Dylan grew disappointed with how some of the songs sounded. In fact, he was about to scrap half of the album.
My name is Ross Altman. I'm a Los Angeles-based folk singer, and I write for folkworks.org.
This is Harvey Kubernick, and I'm the author of Turn Up the Radio, Rock, Pop, and Roll in Los Angeles,
1956 to 1972. Before the retail release of Blood on the Tracks, I was invited to Columbia Records in West Hollywood on Sunset Boulevard to hear an advance acetate pressing of this new Bob Dylan album.
The festival was over. The boys were all planning for a fall. The cabaret was quiet, except for the drilling in the wall.
And pretty soon, I was sent one of those advanced promo copies of the original album pressing.
It was at that point that Dylan said, I don't like this album, I don't want to put it out. So Dylan stood up to Columbia Records. That's speaking truth to power. He went back to the studio and he took his own advice, bringing it all back home. He went back to Minneapolis, Minnesota, and he recorded for the second time half of the album.
Writer and instructor Ashley Kahn.
The story about why he wanted to redo it in Minneapolis really has a lot more to do, I think, with his brother, David Zimmerman, who worked with him and helped him produce the Minneapolis sessions, which eventually redid 5 out of 10 of the songs that he had done before in New York, had a lot to do with the sort of dark feeling he got from the songs, and also from the fact that some of them weren't that great. They weren't great performances, and he felt they could be performed better. And if you do an A-B comparison, because a lot of this music has been released now, absolutely, it was a great idea, and hats off to David for stepping in and convincing his brother to, you know, redo it. Not only, you know, and there was the question of like, oh, now Bob has to go back to New York. And he said, Bob, you don't have to go back to New York. There's some great studios here in Minneapolis. They're up to speed, and there's some great musicians here.
One of those musicians was a railroad brakeman named Kevin Odegaard, whose 1974 was grinding toward an uneventful ending.
In December 1974, I was watching Kojak with my roomie Joe, also a brakeman on the railroad.
Hey, baby, don't call me no Stoolie. I'm an anonymous source of reliable information.
Ooh, love that. Anonymous source, yeah, baby.
My phone was ringing off the hook. I guess we were both trying to avoid going out in the cold and going to work, so I let it ring and ring and ring, and finally I picked it up, and it was not the railroad. On the other end was David Zimmerman, the younger brother of Bob Dylan, and David was asking about a guitar. David was very tentative about the conversation. He tiptoed in.
Odegaard knew musician Chris Weber, who ran a guitar store nearby, who just happened to have the small Martin guitar Dylan was looking for. Weber said he'd bring the guitar to Dylan. In more calls, David Zimmerman went on to ask Kevin Odegaard if he could help him put together a band to come to Sound 80, a local Minneapolis studio, that Friday night, December 27th.
I could sense Bob in the room behind David at that point. I knew that Bob was whispering in David's ear. Wasn't hard to tell. One thing led to another. David threw some names out. I threw some names out. And David countered with, well, how about Bill Berg and Billy Peterson? This great rhythm section that was the house rhythm section for Sound 80 Studios. They were used on all the ads, all the Northwest Airlines stuff. They were jazz musicians, wonderful people, and he had then asked for a keyboard player. In Minneapolis, I was working with Greg Inhofer, who's a great friend, and so I suggested Greg. Didn't hear from anybody again until 5 o'clock Friday night when we all showed up in the parking lot at Sound 80, wondering what we'd gotten ourselves into.
Hi, I'm Bill Berg. I was the session drummer on the Blood on the Tracks Bob Dylan album back in 1974.
I'm Billy Peterson, and I was the bass player on Blood on the Tracks. I show up and I walk through the door at Sound 80 that I'd done so many times before, and I walk through and I look in the studio and there's Bob. So I back out with my instruments and I said, David, that's your really famous brother, man. That's not you in the studio. That's your famous brother, Bob. I said, what's going on here? And then he started to proceed to tell me about how he wanted to re-record part of the album that he had done in New York. And I said, oh yeah, man, this is going to live. That was my sentiment on it. I was going, oh, come on, Dave, man, what?
Actually, Bob was there. He was in the vending machine room when we all arrived. And when he came in the studio, he didn't make any fuss or call any attention to himself. He walked around, shook everybody's hand. He has a famously limp handshake, which, you know, reads, "Don't get too close." And so we were all kind of wary of that.
And my first encounter with him was just being introduced, and he was very cordial, very nice, man, you know, Hibbing. And we're all from Minnesota here, so I actually felt real at ease that some of the horror stories that had preceded Dylan in the studio actually never came out. And very warm. I remember Jacob Dylan running around the studio. He was a little boy in those days, man, and Bob was kind of preoccupied with his son, trying to make sure he was cool while the session was going on.
Billy was setting up a stand-up bass, and Bill Berg was putting his drums together. Greg Inhofer set up the B3 organ. Bob turned to Chris Weber, who was tuning a 12-string, and said, "You, come with me." And he took Chris into the sound booth, the vocal booth, on the far end of this great room in South Minneapolis, and started playing songs back and forth. And they got along famously. So he taught the songs to Chris, and that was how the sessions played out from that point forward. First song, "Idiot Wind." He's pissed off, if I can say that on the radio. It was obvious, and he kept his fever up for all five takes. He was in a state. He was really in a state. This one, he's spitting it out. "Someone's got it in for me. They're planning stories in the press.
Someone's got it in for me. They're planting stories in the press. Whoever it is, I wish they cut it out quick. But when they will, I can only guess. They say I shot a man named Gray and took his wife to Italy. She inherited $1 million, and when she died, it came to me. I can help it if I'm lucky. People see me all the time, and they just can't remember how to act. Their minds are filled with big ideas, images, and distorted facts. Even you, yesterday, you had to ask me where it was at. I couldn't believe after all these years you didn't know me any better than that, sweet lady.
And it's just a tour de force where he's showing us very clear images and yet these little examples of life. "They say I shot a man named Gray and took his wife to Italy. She inherited $1 million, and when she died, it came to me. I can't help it if I'm lucky." What is that from? I mean, is that a metaphor for how lucky his career came? It's not really sure, but instead of just using imagery, jingle, jangle, morning, he's giving us stories and bits of life. You're really getting a sense that you're getting close to Dylan when he said, "People see me all the time, they just can't remember how to act." He's discussing in lyrics what it's like to be a famous person in America where people don't treat you like a person anymore. And the ultimate shame to him, "Even you, yesterday, you had to ask me where it was at. Couldn't believe after all these years you didn't know me any better than that." The sense that if you know me well enough, you don't have to ask me, you should be close enough to know who I am, that even people close to him were being distanced. And him sharing that really gives you a sense of Dylan the man and what it's been like to be Bob Dylan.
"Idiot Wind" is not just about his upset with his marriage. If you really look at it, it's his upset with being a celebrity, with celebrity culture. It's very forward-looking. You know, you think about how things are today, and "Idiot Wind," you know.
Anger is one of his, I think, most fertile emotions. And "Idiot Wind" is an example of that. You know, you get this catalog of denunciations until finally you just come down to, you know, "You're an idiot, babe." You know, I mean, it's amazing.
Just an epic. Again, showing us that previously where the wind was, where we looked for answers.
Taking that central image from his classic folk protest song, Blowing in the Wind, and really turning it on its head.
Now here comes the idiot wind blowing in this idiocy. And it seems very strongly directed at this one woman who many say is Sarah, including Jacob Dylan, Bob's son, saying this was our parents talking. But it's important to understand that Dylan includes himself at the end. We're idiots, babe.
Ahead, we'll hear the Minneapolis recordings of some of the other songs recorded there that made it to Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks. And we'll hear more from the musicians who have never received credit on any release of Blood on the Tracks. Plus more from the rest of our panel of writers and Dylan fans when we continue with Right on Target, So Direct, Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks. I'm Paul Ingalls, back with more in a moment.
Support for KFAI comes from the Cedar Cultural Center, presenting Emmy Woods with Low Jam, Dakota Fay, and Laura Hugo, Saturday, January 10th. It'll be a double release party with country, folk, blues, singer-songwriter Emmy Woods debuting their new album, When the Day Breaks, an intimate album about love, loss, healing, and redemption. In addition, the title track will also be released as a hip-hop version, written and arranged with Dakota Fay and Low Jam. All of them will perform along with special guest Laura Hugo. More information about Emmy Woods with Low Jam, Dakota Fay, and Laura Hugo can be found at thecedar.org.
You are tuned in to Mini Culture Presents here on KFEI Fresh Air Community Radio, 90.3 FM in the Twin Cities, people-powered radio. Support for this program comes from KFEI listener members and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Today here on Mini Culture Presents, we are celebrating the 50th anniversary of Bob Dylan's 1975 album, Blood on the Tracks, in a music-heavy special about the creation of the album and the singer from independent producer Paul Ingalls in Albuquerque, New Mexico. If you are a lover of this album and would like an even deeper dive, in 2014, Columbia Records released the Bootleg Series, Volume 14, More Blood, More Tracks. The St. Paul Public Library has the deluxe edition of this on their shelves. It is 6 discs of alternate versions, recordings, and takes and rehearsals of the songs. It is indeed a fascinating listen. But if over a dozen versions of You're Gonna Make Me Lonesome When You Go sounds like a bit much for you, they did also put out a single disc sampler. I bet you can find both versions at the Electric Fetus and Mill City Music if you prefer. Also in 2013, the University of Minnesota Press released Blood in the Tracks, the Minnesota musicians behind Dylan's masterpiece by Paul Metza and Rick Shefchik. And you can find that in bookstores around town and also the St. Paul Public Library. But for now, back to our story.
This is Paul Ingalls, and you're listening to Right on Target, So Direct, Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks. Musicians, music writers, and fans recall what made Bob Dylan's 15th studio album the number one favorite in a 2012 Rolling Stone magazine fan poll of all Dylan albums. We're also hearing from some of the Minneapolis studio musicians who were surprised to be called in to work with Bob Dylan in the last week of December 1974, re-recording half of an album that Dylan had recorded in New York just 3 months earlier. Having recorded Idiot Wind with Dylan, the next song attempted was You're a Big Girl Now.
You're a big girl now.
Here again from NPR Music is Ann Powers.
Yeah, as a young woman, I was always intrigued by the song You're a Big Girl Now, which of course is a kind of a mix of beautiful, loving poeticism and a bit of masculine condescension, but that a woman outgrows a male lover. I think now that I am a grown woman myself, I can see how a song about how a woman outgrows a man might indicate that man isn't able to accept the full woman. But certainly, as a young woman, I was quite moved by Dylan's pain, his vulnerability in that song, and also that idea of him sitting and watching. You know, there's this whole image in the song about this bird on the horizon sitting on the fence, that is him, that he is sort of observing his love as she moves into a different space. That lyric also reminds me of the blues of Robert Johnson, reminds me of some classic Delta blues, which I think definitely was a source for this song for Dylan, definitely was inspiration throughout Dylan's career.
Our conversation was short and sweet. It nearly swept me off of my feet, and I'm back in the rain.
Minneapolis musician Kevin Odegaard.
We all went back to our lives. Without another thought, it was all quiet for the next 24 hours. Late Saturday afternoon, the phone rang again. I jumped at it, picked it up, and it was David Zimmerman. And he said, well, Bob was really happy with what we did on Friday, and he'd like you all to come back. So he helped me line up these guys for Monday night. And I said, sure I would. We arrived at the studio again Monday night at 5 o'clock, and I was very pleased to be invited to pull out my Martin D28 and start tuning up, and we were going to learn a new song. So Chris and Bob went into the vocal booth and learned Tangled Up in Blue. The song came out of the booth in the key of G. Bob stopped playing and said, well, you know, it's lacking something. What, how does it sound to you? And then he turned to me, and I kind of forgot where I was, and I said, well, it's just kind of, you know, it's passable. And he turned to me and said, passable? And I said, yeah, it's good, but I think it would be better if we moved it up a key. It would have more energy. It would give it some more drive. And so he looked around the room, and there were no rolling eyeballs, so we all, except Bob, put capos on, and he played in the key of A. And we played about 5-6 bars. He said, yeah, yeah, that's it. That's good. Let's go.
Early one morning, the sun was shining. I was laying in bed, wondering if she'd changed it all, if her hair was still red. Her folks, they set our lives together. Sure was gonna be rough. They never did like mama's homemade dress. Papa's bankbook wasn't big enough. And I was standing on the side of the road, rain falling on my shoes, heading out for the East Coast. Lord knows I paid some dues getting through. Tangled up in blue. She was married when we first met, soon to be divorced. I helped her out of a jam, I guess, but I used a little too much force. We drove that car as far as we could, abandoned it out west. Split up on the docks at night, both agreeing it was best. And she turned around to look at me as I was walking away. I heard her say over my shoulder, I'm blue.
Here again, Anthony DeCurtis from Rolling Stone magazine.
To say that Blood on the Tracks was as good a record as Dylan made in the 60s, Tangled Up in Blue is as good as any song he wrote in the 60s. And it's a very different kind of song for him. And it's so complicated.
Music writer Paul Zolo.
And Dylan once explained that he was studying art, visual art, with Norman Rabin in New York, and an elder artist who taught him to paint the light. And I think that encouraged him to really paint images. So he really gave us scenes that are scenes out of little movies that are remarkable.
A great relationship, usually when one looks back on it, it's snapshots.
Writer and instructor Ashley Kahn.
Snapshots of this moment, this weekend in, you know, Massachusetts, the trip out to California. And that really is one of the aspects of Tangled Up in Blue and the whole album, really, is these visual moments that he records.
Singer-songwriter Mary Gaucher.
Tangled Up in Blue is just so epic. He is on a biblical journey here. We're not exactly sure, literally, what he's talking about, but we can feel the journey. The poet is still on fire here, and what a song that is.
One of the things about the songs on Blood on the Tracks is that they proceed as if they're narratives. You know, you hear this kind of catalog of events, you know, this happened and that happened and she did this and I went there. But there's really no way to put those events together. I mean, the key line in Tangled Up in Blue, it comes at the very end. You know, we always did feel the same. We just saw it from a different point of view. Seeing things from a different point of view is exactly what Tangled Up in Blue is about. The point of view keeps shifting. So you don't really know who's telling the story at any particular point. It's fractured. It's really like, you know, like looking at a cubist painting or something. Every angle that you look at it from, it looks different. So Tangled Up in Blue mixes perspectives. It mixes points of view. It mixes what is unconscious and being thought and what actually occurred in the world. And it mixes the past and the present and the future. But it gets at everything. But me, I'm still on the road, heading for another joint. We always did feel the same, we just saw it from a different point of view.
Tangled Up in Blue. Tangled Up in Blue is like the pièce de résistance, you know? I mean, it's like, what? Ugh, there's just not a thing wrong with Tangled Up in Blue. Just brilliant.
Bob Dylan is so fond of saying, you know, everyone asks me what these songs mean. Nobody asks them, you ain't nothing but a hound dog crying all the time. No one asks what that means.
Bob knew he had it. He nailed the harmonica solo. I was about 5 feet away on that very final chord when we strum, strum, strum. And we all just sat there silent, including Bob, for 30 seconds. It was a moment that musicians know. It's the moment when you do good work together. And we all kind of bowed our heads and looked around the room, and there was a great feeling of fulfillment in the air at the end of Tangled Up in Blue. I can tell you that. Billy had left, so Chris and Bill Berg and Greg Inhofer and Bob Dylan carried on. Peter Ostrusko was called late Monday. He got a message to please bring your mandolin over to Sound 80, and he did so.
I love If You See Her, Say Hello, because it represents something different than those more violent emotions that Blood on the Tracks also captures.
That's NPR Music's Ann Powers, and this is Anthony DeCurtis of Rolling Stone magazine.
I mean, the line, the title is almost a cliché. That sense of running into someone who's going to run into your ex, and he can't resist that impulse to not only send along his good wishes, but to start reliving elements of the relationship and, you know, being very wistful about it. It's as if there's still a communication between the two, you know, in the singer's heart and in his mind. And that's what comes across in the song.
And I think his vocal on this song is one of my favorites of all of his vocals, because it's so gentle and so philosophical in a sense.
It's just him pouring his heart out. And when somebody does that, whether it's a painting, a actor or actress in a movie, I'm very easily teared up because of what they've given to me. And it's that tune is a gift, I think, to people if they really listen to it.
If you see her, say hello. She might be in Tangier. She left here last early spring. Is living there, I hear. Say for me that I'm all right. Though things get kind of slow, she might think that I've forgotten her. Though tell her it isn't so. We had a falling out, like lovers often will. And to think of how she left that night, it still brings me a chill. And though our separation, it pierced me to the heart. She still lives inside of me. We've never been apart.
If You See Her, Say Hello was the romantic benediction at the end of the service, so to speak, that Bob Dylan led. It was a spiritual moment. It was a sad moment. It was a moment of great thoughtfulness and great sadness, and the perfect way to end those sessions.
The last song recorded in Minneapolis by Bob Dylan with musicians Chris Weber, Bill Berg, and Peter Ostroushko, and engineer Paul Martinson and Kevin Odegaard in the booth. Bassist Billy Peterson had been there earlier at Sound 80 Studios, December 30th, 1974. All five songs the Little Band of Unknowns cut with Dylan that week wound up on what many say is his best album.
By the time you get to the end of Blood on the Tracks, you know, it's really a very exhausting emotional experience. Buckets of Rain, you know, again, you know, I've been evoking Shakespeare a lot. I mean, I think about him in relationship with Dylan often. You know, there's a Shakespeare line in a song in one of the plays, you know, the rain it raineth every day. And this Buckets of Rain has the same kind of idea, you know, the rain of our emotions, you know, the rain of, you know, things that cast over our life. And there's a kind of acceptance and also a kind of fatalism about the song. And Buckets of Rain is the finale. It's, you know, it's like the little character who, you know, would come out and sing a song at the end of, you know, at the end of a Shakespeare play and send you off with a message that in its way is meant to let all of the emotions that you've just experienced somehow sit well with you. And then you take them with you out into the world.
Buckets of rain, buckets of tears, got all them buckets coming out of my ears. Buckets of moonbeams in my hand. You got all the love, honey, baby, I can stand.
Here again, music writer Ross Altman.
To me, it's Bob Dylan's answer to Albert Camus' first question of philosophy. And what Albert Camus said, the co-father with Sartre of modern existentialism, was that the first question of philosophy is whether to commit suicide. When Dylan comes to the last song on the album, Buckets of Rain, he reaches that point that I think epitomizes what Camus had in mind when he says in the very last verse, life is sad, life is a bust. All you can do is do what you must. You do what you must do. And then he finds the answer. Then he finds the answer to that sense of despair that's been on the edge of all these songs. You do what you must do, and you do it well. You do it well. And then, in the next line, he even finds a way out of this, the isolation from the divorce, and he reaches back out to the love of his life. I'll do it for you, honey baby, can't you tell? That is the answer that too many American songwriters and musicians were never able to find. And Dylan finally found it in 1975. And I think it's pulled a lot of people, including me, out of the depths of some very painful situations.
Life is sad, life is a bust. All you can do is do what you must. You do what you must do, and you do it well. I do it for you, honey baby, can't you tell?
Again, singer-songwriter Mary Gaucher.
It's a longing that we carry, and I think probably Dylan has been the one to write about it the best. That constant aching and longing is not going anywhere. It's the human condition. It's why poets weep. It's why we need poets. It's why we need Dylan.
In just a little over 6 months from the release of Blood on the Tracks, Bob Dylan had recorded more tunes that would be released in January of 1976 on the album Desire. In October of 1975, he was already performing some of those songs on the Rolling Thunder Review Tour. Although Sarah Dillon was reportedly in the studio for some of the Desire sessions and was filmed on parts of the tour, their relationship apparently couldn't be saved. Sarah Dillon filed for divorce from Bob Dylan in March of 1977. Right on target, so direct, Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks was written and produced by me, Paul Ingalls. Special thanks to Kevin Odegaard, Billy Peterson and Bill Berg, Sean Colvin, Mary Gaucher, Peter Mulvey, Casey Neal, and John Spurney. Thanks, too, to music writers Anthony DeCurtis, Ann Powers, Paul Zolo, Ross Altman, Ashley Kahn, and Harvey Kubernick. Thanks so much for listening.
Thanks for joining us here on Mini Culture Presents today as we honored Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks, celebrating the 50th anniversary of its release in January of 2025. I've been your curator, Michael Whetstone, and as I said earlier, if you enjoyed this program but want to take a deeper dive, in 2014, Columbia Records released the Bootleg Series, Volume 14, More Blood, More Tracks. And the St. Paul Public Library has the deluxe edition on their shelves. It's 6 discs of alternate versions, recordings, rehearsals, and takes of the songs. It is a stunning document just to hear how differently he can treat the same song moments later in a different take. And the lyric sheets are wild to look at, oftentimes seemingly written on the fly. It's remarkable to see and to hear, too. However, if 6 discs sounds like a bit much for you to take in, they also put out a single disc sampler that the library doesn't have, but you can probably pick it up at the Electric Fetus or Mill City Music. Also in 2023, the University of Minnesota Press released Blood in the Tracks, the Minnesota Musicians Behind Dylan's Masterpiece by Paul Metza and Rick Sheftick, which you can find in bookstores around town, and they also have a copy at the St. Paul Public Library. You are tuned into KFEI 90.3 FM in the Twin Cities, KFEI Radio Without Boundaries. Please help to keep this station growing with a financial contribution today. Thank you for your continued support of this public broadcast service, and thank you for being a part of the KFEI family, and thank you for listening. Support for this program comes from KFEI listener members and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Coming up next, The Upside Down.